Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday. My co-host is Adam Wybury. Today we're talking about Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator by Roald Dahl. A transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hi, Adam.
Hello, Ren, you rascal. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Are you in the mood to talk about a weird book?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to say about this book of random malarkey.
yeah, Charlie and the Random Malarkey.
Yeah, but it's an interesting one. And considering what an impression it made on me as a kid, I could hardly remember any of it.
Well, same. Yeah. This is Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator by Roald Dahl from 1973, illustrated by Faith Jack.
What? I've got the Quentin Blake illustrated copy.
Oh, do you? Oh, okay. So this is, I was going to ask, do the cover check first, because I deliberately got a vintage edition.
Oh, no, I've got the new edition, so I assume. I mean, it still seemed pretty offensive to me, so I can't imagine.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, I'm curious to see.
Yeah, I don't think it's been that edited. If it happened, like, you know, after all this farrago about editing Roald Dahl to make him politically correct and so on, they left a lot in, if so.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that. Okay, what's your front cover?
My front cover is definitely a scritchy Quentin Blake illustration, and it's of Willy Wonka, Charlie and Grandpa Joe ascending in the elevator above the planet Earth into space.
So your interior illustrations are different too. That's interesting. Okay, so mine is... from 1978, and it has a full colour illustration on the front that shows the whole crew, Willy Wonka, Charlie, Grandpa Joe, Charlie's parents, and then the rest of the grandparents in their bed, and crammed into this glass elevator. But they look quite jolly about it, and they're descending into a green pastoral landscape and being hailed by the Oompa Loompas.
Oh, interesting. And what do the Oompa Loompas look like?
The Oompa Loompas are just small white people.
Okay.
Wearing loincloths.
Yeah, I mean, that's similar to Quentin Blake's illustrations of them, I would say.
Yeah.
They've got very sticky up hair, but that's pretty much how Quentin Blake does hair anyway, so...
So what's
your memory of this book?
My memory of this book is just Vermicious Canids and Grandma Georgina becoming a Minus.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, and that is it.
and a general ambience of dread and confusion.
Exactly. A general sense that it is a bad book. Not in terms of quality, but in terms of being malevolent.
Yes, being a wrong book.
Which it is. So you might hide. Like, you might not want it to look at you on your bookshelf. That kind of book.
I felt like that about The Witches. But this is a much weirder book than The Witches. The Witches is straightforwardly scary. You know, it's basically a horror book for kids, and we've got The Witches. Now, this ostensibly is science fiction, I suppose. I mean, a kind of fantastic Jules Verne-esque romp, perhaps.
Yeah.
But it's probably more deeply unsettling, like existentially unsettling, than The Witches.
Yeah.
And I think especially if you go into it expecting anything like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because structurally it's so different. Because Charlie and the Chocolate Factory has a really satisfying narrative progression in which you have Charlie, who's the good kid, and then a bunch of naughty kids going through trials which expose the naughty kids as naughty, and they receive some kind of comeuppance. And then Charlie is rewarded with the chocolate factory at the end of the book. Whereas this, the plotting of this book is really weird. And I've been thinking, it's really hard to describe, because basically it's a book in which simultaneously a lot happens. Like, things happen of ontologically and philosophically massive proportions, like reality warbling proportions in terms of what's happening, and yet simultaneously it's a book in which nothing happens at all and there is zero narrative progression, like completely zero. Like, it's a book of complete stasis, even while this elevator is zooming up into space and then into the bowels of the earth. And I think, and that's a kind of highbrow way to explain it, but I do think that gets to why it's so disturbing as a child. This weird sense that a lot is happening and stuff is happening that makes you kind of question the way reality works in a way that's confusing and strange. And yet, it's really hard to remember what happens because really nothing kind of happens.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It's hard to explain.
It does make sense. Yeah. It doesn't feel like a sequel to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Like a full, it doesn't feel like a proper, it doesn't feel like a proper book.
It doesn't it feel feels like a proper like, book.
It feels like Roald Dahl like had a weird night's sleep and like jotted some stuff down and turned it into a book.
Oh yeah, yeah. It feels like if you're watching an improv show and the improv show had gone on for 24 hours and all the performers were really sleep deprived and they were still trying to be funny, and some of it was kind of funny but other bits were just confusing and scary.
Yeah, it does feel like that.
Yeah, and stuff was happening but it didn't really make sense.
But also it's doing that using these characters who you have felt become quite beloved, but just putting them in these alarming and nonsensical situations that feels quite frightening for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I think you'd also expect more of the Chocolate Factory. And you get...
You would.
You get some of the Chocolate Factory... But also it turns out that this chocolate factory contains a minus land, which seems to be the realm of the not yet born. Right? Okay, so
yes.
So that's an astral plane. So somehow a chocolate factory owned by an eccentric billionaire contains an astral plane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like... that is quite a lot to accept as a reader, I think.
It is. I think it's a big ask. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like the Twin Peaks: The Return. You know, if Charlie the Chocolate Factory is original Twin Peaks, this is Twin Peaks: The Return, where it's like, right, you wanted weird, now this is going to be weird.
So, yeah, this book sort of begins pretty directly after Charlie and the Chocolate Factory left off.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it immediately? Yeah. With Charlie's extended family being collected by Willy Wonka in his glass elevator, as Charlie has been chosen to inherit the factory. And there's still there's his parents, and there's still these three other grandparents who refuse to leave their bed, so the bed comes with them too. But like Willy Wonka insists that in order to re-enter the factory, they have to go higher first.
Why? Why?
Yeah. So they keep going higher and higher. And I think reasonably, Grandma Josephine panics at Willy Wonka's erratic behaviour, but it sort of prevents Wonka from pressing the correct combination of buttons at the correct moment. And oops, they are in orbit. They're spotted by the pilots of a transport capsule for Space Hotel USA, which is a vast hotel that's about to be furnished with crew from this capsule. And Wonka decides that it would be fun to beat the shuttle to the Space Hotel and get on board before they do. So they do, and they encounter.
Well, before the encounter, right?
Yeah,
you know, there's quite a long chapter with the president and
yes,
various sort of members of state, and I don't understand how Roald Dahl thought this would be appealing or interesting to kids. It's really odd. Yes. It reads like this kind of strange political cartoon or satire of American politics, kind of aimed for children. But what it's doing in this book, I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. Like, who knows? Like, the President of the United States is quite an important character in this book for no reason. And he's a very kind of sort of stupid and kind of emasculated president. I don't know if this is meant to be aimed at Nixon, who I guess would have been president at the time.
It doesn't feel like, if it's a parody of Nixon, it's a really weird parody of Nixon.
Really, yeah.
Like, because if you're going to parody Nixon, right, he needs to be kind of weaselly and conniving and grotesque. And this president is just sort of like a soft boy.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of comedy business between him and his nanny, who seems Miss Tibbs, who is, to quote, the power behind the throne. She stood no nonsense from anyone. Some people said she was as strict with the president now as when he was a little boy. And she even gets a strange kind of A.A. Milne, Lewis Carroll-style song that about the president.
She does. It's all entirely baffling. I think the bit that has probably been somewhat edited between our versions is the exchange with the Prime Minister of China.
No, I don't think it's been edited.
Has it not?
I mean,
okay. Cool.
I mean, it's funny because, you know, I like to see myself as someone who's kind of against too much censorship or so on, but it's not on, to be honest. It's a rough read. It's basically the kind of most corny, cringy kind of jokes about how Chinese people stereotypically speak.
Yeah.
Over like two pages.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad.
Right. It's like you've just wandered in some awful kind of Bernard Manning or like Ken Dodd routine, basically.
Yeah. Like, why?
And also, yeah, not only is it offensive and rubbish, but why? Like, there's no reason for it to be there at all, like, on any level. Like, narratively, like... Like, yeah. The whole chapter doesn't need to be there. Like, why is there this chapter about this soft boy president? It's completely inexplicable.
Yeah. I completely forgot all of that. I guess I probably didn't really read it very... It probably wasn't very interesting to my 10-year-old self.
Yeah.
unsurprisingly.
So yeah, after Roald Dahl's got that out of his system, then our intrepid band of explorers do arrive at the Space Hotel.
Yeah, and there is some there's some malarkey where they're listening, the president is listening in to, or the NASA are listening in to their exploration of this hotel. So Willy Wonka pretends to speak Martian. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not Spike Milligan quality, this, I have to admit. Like, you know, it's a bit like on the Ning Nang Nong, but it's basically just silly noises.
Silly noises. And then when you think this book might just be a bit boring, it becomes terrifying. I was going to read. I feel like we probably need to. Well, I kind of want to read a fair bit.
I was going to say, feel free to basically read chapter 7, frankly. Or the end of chapter 6 and chapter 7, because, this is where the children's horror really suddenly hits.
Okay. In the lobby of the Space Hotel, Mr. Wonka had merely paused in order to think up another verse, and he was just about to start off again when a frightful, piercing scream stopped him cold. The screamer was Grandma Josephine. She was sitting up in bed and pointing with shaking finger at the lifts at the far end of the lobby. She screamed a second time, still pointing, and all eyes turned towards the lift. The door of the one on the left was sliding slowly open, and the watchers could clearly see that there was something. Something thick, something brown, something not exactly brown, but greenish brown, something with slimy skin and large eyes, squatting inside the lift. Chapter 7. Something nasty in the lifts. Grandma Josephine had stopped screaming now. She'd gone rigid with shock. The rest of the group by the bed, including Charlie and Grandpa Joe, had become as still as stone. They dared not move. They dared hardly breathe. And Mr. Wonka, who had swung quickly around to look when the first scream came, was as dumbstruck as the rest. He stood motionless, gaping at the thing in the lift, his mouth slightly open, his eyes stretched wide as two wheels. What he saw, what they all saw, was this. It looked more than anything like an enormous egg balanced on its pointed end. It was as tall as a big boy and wider than the fattest man. The greenish-brown skin had a shiny, wettish appearance, and there were wrinkles in it. About three-quarters of the way up, in the widest part, there were two large round eyes as big as teacups. The eyes were white, but each had a brilliant red pupil in the centre. The red pupils were resting on Mr. Wonka. But now they began driving slowly across to Charlie and Grandpa Joe and the others by the bed, settling upon them and gazing at them with a cold, malevolent stare. The eyes were everything. There were no other features, no nose or mouth or ears, but the entire egg-shaped body was itself moving very, very slightly, pulsing and bulging gently here and there, as though the skin were filled with some thick fluid. At this point, Charlie suddenly noticed that the next lift was coming down. The indicator numbers above the door were flashing. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. L for lobby. There was a slight pause. The door slid open, and there, inside the second lift, was another enormous, slimy, wrinkled, greenish-brown egg with eyes. Now the numbers were flashing above all three of the remaining lifts. Down they came, down, 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 and soon, at precisely the same time, they reached the lobby floor and the door slid open. Five open doors now, one creature in each, five in all. And five pairs of eyes with brilliant red centres, all watching Mr. Wonka and watching Charlie and Grandpa Joe and the others. There were slight differences in size and shape between the five, but all had the same greenish-brown wrinkled skin, and the skin was rippling and pulsing. For about 30 seconds, nothing happened. Nobody stirred, nobody made a sound. The silence was terrible. So was the suspense. Charlie was so frightened he felt himself shrinking inside his skin. Then he saw the creature in the left-hand lift suddenly starting to change shape. Its body was slowly becoming longer and longer, and thinner, going up and up towards the roof of the lift. Not straight up, but curving a little to the left, making a snake-like curve that was curiously graceful, up to the left, and then curling over the top to the right, and coming down again in a half-circle. And then the bottom end began to grow out as well, like a tail, creeping along the floor to the left, until at last the creature, which had originally looked like a huge egg, now looked like a long curvy serpent standing up on its tail. Right, here we get an illustration of that, at least in my edition.
So, same here, but what does your illustration look like? Like, is it coloured or is it black and white? No,
it's black and white. It's like a line drawing. Of this creature in the door of the lift in the shape of an S with its one eye looking out. Quite textured. Then the one in the next lift began stretching itself in much the same way, and what a weird and oozy thing it was to watch. It was twisting itself into a shape that was a bit different from the first, balancing itself almost but not quite on the tip of its tail. Then the three remaining creatures began stretching themselves all at the same time, each one elongating itself slowly upward, growing taller and taller, thinner and thinner, curving and twisting, stretching and stretching, curling and bending, balancing either on the tail or the head or both, and turned sideways now so that only one eye was visible. When they had all stopped stretching and bending, this was how they finished up. And here we see the full display of them spelling out.
Scram!
Shouted Mr. Wonka. Get out, quick! People have never moved faster than Grandpa Joe and Charlie and Mr. and Mrs. Bucket at that moment. They all got behind the bed and started pushing like crazy. Mr. Wonka ran in front of them shouting, Scram! 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 And in 10 seconds flat, all of them were out of the lobby and back inside the great glass elevator. Frantically, Mr. Wonka began undoing bolts and pressing buttons. The door of the great glass elevator snapped shut and the whole thing leaped sideways. They were away. And of course, all of them, including the three old ones in the bed, floated up again into the air. Yeah.
I think maybe why it's so effective is because things have been quite slow and sedate up to that part. And then, yeah, I mean, I love the suspense built up by all the elevators coming down.
Yeah.
That's terrific.
It's effective horror.
Yeah, and it's just a weird image, like these sort of egg-like shapes. And I think maybe when you think of eggs, you think of that kind of perfect smoothness and the hardness, and then the fact that they're also bulging and pulsing underneath, that they seem kind of liquidy.
Yeah.
I mean, that encapsulates my texture of the week.
Yeah, yeah, shall we?
Shall we sing? I mean, I was thinking there's the Oompa Loompa Diddly Do, isn't there, from the film of texture of the week
I mean, it is basically the vermicious canids, but I got an extra one, which is later when they are re-entering Earth's atmosphere with a vermicious canid wrapped around the elevator, and it starts burning up, and it says it made a noise like bacon frying.
Oh, yeah. How horrid.
How horrid. Yeah. Willy Wonka explains to them that these creatures are vermicious canids.
Yeah, they're dirty beasts.
Dirty beasts. He tells Charlie, if they'd have got them, you'd have been a cooked cucumber. You'd have been rasped into 1,000 tiny bits, grated like cheese and flocculated alive. They'd have made necklaces from your knuckle bones and bracelets from your teeth. Charlie, in kind of what sort of feels a bit like a kind of editorial insert, is like, but why would they tell us to scram if they want to kill us and eat us? And Wonka says, well, it's the only word they know. Okay.
But while they don't kill and eat Wonka and co, they certainly do kill and eat a lot of subsidiary characters who aren't important.
They do. Yeah, in the poor space hotel staff, get thoroughly chomped upon.
Not the astronauts, only the working class staff, I note.
Yeah. The bellhops and the maids, etc.
Which is broadcast, or the sound of it is broadcast live across the entire globe.
It is. Before that, the Great Glass Elevator is chased by an enormous vermicious canid that sort of butts itself against them.
Yeah, with like the pointy end of the egg, which turns out to be its butt.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole song about the vermicious canid's butt.
There is.
At times, this is a weirdly butt-centred book.
Yeah. So we can politely pass over that, I think. then we get the nurse's song, which is
I don't know what the tune is. I maybe I should go for it. This
mighty man, of whom I sing the greatest of them all, was once a teeny tiny thing, just 18 inches tall. I knew him as a tiny tot. I nursed him on my knee. I used to sit him on the pot and wait for him to wee.
And so on.
And so on. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it is very like the speak roughly to your little boy and beat him when he sneezes. From Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, yeah, it is. He only does it to annoy.
Because he knows it teases.
Yeah.
That happens.
And then we get an epic space battle.
And then we get an epic space battle. A squadron of vermicious canids attacks the transport capsule, the Great Glass Elevator has to tow them to safety. The survivors.
It's like something out of H.G. Wells crossed with a really obscure, stupid adventure game puzzle.
And then all of these vermicious canids start. Well, one of them wraps itself, turns it into a snake, and wraps itself around the elevator. And then the rest of them form a chain. And they're trying to hook onto the elevator and and the space capsule and draw them back, but Wonka manages to find the sort of downward acceleration button, and they end up streaking through the Earth's atmosphere and burning up all the Vimicious Canid. And then they crash back into the chocolate factory.
Yeah, halfway into the book.
Halfway
into this sequel to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Roald Dahl's best known book.
Yeah. So then we sort of get a kind of reset.
Yeah, so basically that first half of the book might as well not have happened. It's kind of a prologue, I guess.
So if you're feeling suitably discombobbled, you're like, oh, okay, now we're back in the chocolate factory. We're familiar with this. Oompa Loompas, yeah, we know them. but the grandparents will still not get out of bed.
And Willy Wonka has some kind of strange plan to have them work in the factory. Like, his main reason for them out of bed is their labour, as far as I could take it, which is quite odd. Like, so Charlie now owns the chocolate factory, and of course Charlie is going to get his bedridden grandparents to labour away in the factory until they die. Like, I just found that completely inexplicable.
Yeah. Charlie's, in case you're wondering, Charlie's parents have next to no bearing on anything. They are just about there.
Yeah, only just about there. They're quite eerie, actually.
Yeah. they're so void. It's a bit odd.
Yeah, like, they're given so little dialogue, and when they do, it's all kind of very generic. It's really strange.
So Wonka's plan is to use his de-aging medicine, Wonkavite, on the grandparents.
And if you didn't think that Willy Wonka possibly offing or killing off young children, or at least putting them into perilous situations in Chocolate Factory, was bad enough, here it turns out that he's been conducting experiments on the Oompa Loompas that seemingly are so horrific he won't even directly talk about them, even when pressed repeatedly by other characters. It's all he's like, well, it took hundreds of experimental attempts. They're like, okay, what happened? He's like, well, not gonna talk about that.
It's really ominous.
It's so, like, and it's like, I guess that's sort of the character. Like, that's how Gene Wilder obviously played him in the film.
Yeah.
But, like, I think it tips the balance from kind of eccentric billionaire into, like, genuinely terrifying evil scientist.
Yeah, genuine madman.
Yeah, it's quite disturbing.
but despite this, the grandparents do decide they will take these pills, and in fact become so keen that they each take four. An Oompa Loompa comes and sings them a song about it. Then they take four of these pills each, despite the Oompa Loompa quite clearly singing that they will each reduce their life, their age by 20 years.
And I guess this is a bit of a kind of callback to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in which the Oompa Loompas sing about the dangers of, say, you know, gluttony, that a child commits gluttony, or the danger of watching too much TV, and then a child watches too much TV, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a kind of anti-being greedy thing, maybe. It feels like there was some really half-hearted edutainment bits in this book, but it's like Roald Dahl's editors or his publishers have said, look, Ro, you've got to put in some stuff to keep the kids on the right track, because some of this is all a bit, you know, like, keep it clean, mate. And so he's like, oh, all right. So he just adds in, like, a random, stupid poem out of nowhere about not taking medicine from the cabinet.
He does, yeah. Yeah, that happens. Just about not taking
laxatives.
Not taking laxatives, yeah, and I didn't deign to remember that at all. So, you know, I think that's... Yeah, that was a... Took me by surprise when I came across that.
I don't know when Dirty Beasts was published, like the collection of poems, but it really feels like a B-side, you know, or like a poem from one of his poetry collections that he was like, ah, it's not very good, and has just shoved it in here.
So they take these four pills, which means that Grandma Josephine and Grandpa George become babies. Grandma Georgina, meanwhile, becomes a minus.
No. that's when child me goes, nope.
No, I know. It's so wrong. It's so horrible. And as you mentioned, this means that Wonka with Charlie in tow have to go to the hellish astral plane within this chocolate factory that is Minus Land.
I hate it so much. Even as an adult, I still hate it. It's awful.
Yeah. Yes, to administer Vita Wonk, which is the antidote. So shall I not get you to read the
description? No, I think I should. The like.
Okay.
I mean, the whole thing is. Oh, I don't know. Okay, so I'll read some of chapter 17. Rescue in Minus Land.
Maybe from Charlie Stood at the Open Door.
Charlie stood at the open door of the elevator and stared into the swirling vapours. This, he thought, is what hell must be like. Hell without heat. There was something unholy about it all, something unbelievably diabolical. It was also deathly quiet, so desolate and empty. At the same time, the constant movement, the twisting and swirling of the misty vapours, gave one the feeling that some very powerful force, evil and malignant, was at work all around. Charlie felt a jab on his arm. He jumped. He almost jumped out of the elevator. "Sorry," said Mr. Wonka. "It's only me." "Oh," Charlie gasped. For a second, I thought..." "I know what you thought, Charlie. By the way, I'm awfully glad you're with me. How would you like to come here alone? As I did. As I had to. Many times."
What he was up to.
I don't know. Suddenly we've gone into like Clive Barker territory or something.
Absolutely deranged. Yeah. So they've seen this sort of ghostly figure of Grandma Georgina in the vapour. And because she doesn't really have a human form anymore, she's a minus.
And to be fair to the illustrators, this is a hard task. So Quentin Blake, I think, cops out a bit and basically draws a ghostly grandma. And it's like, no, that doesn't make sense, because she's aged backwards. So she's aged into a child and then she's the other side. So you can't draw her as old. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this one is still... I mean, her features are very obscured by the mist, but she does still look fairly grandma-esque. Yeah. A tricky job. Well, she, for an illustration.
She needs to look like some kind of impossible fetus.
Yeah, he has to administer the Vita Wonk with a spray gun to ensure that she gets enough. Although he does overdo it.
Oh, he just loves it, doesn't he? He's a trickster. He knows what he's up to.
Yes, he says that she may be a teeny tiny bit overplussed. but when they leave the Hell Dimension and go back up, they find that she is 358.
Can I read the awful description?
Yeah.
Thanks. Her tiny face was like a pickled walnut. There were such masses of creases and wrinkles that the mouth and eyes and even the nose were sunken, almost out of sight. Her hair was pure white and her hands, which were resting on top of the blanket, were just little lumps of wrinkly skin.
And I've got an illustration to go with this, which makes full use of the cross-hatching texture in these wrinkles. I don't think I liked this illustration as a kid.
Yeah, I think I really like Quentin Blake. I think, like, Michael Rosen's Sad Book, as illustrated by Quentin Blake, is one of, you know, the peaks of children's picture books. You know, at his best, I think he is remarkable. He doesn't quite work for Charlie in the Great Glass Elevator. I don't quite know why. I guess he doesn't tend to go in for texture as much. He mostly does line work. And yeah, I don't know. You know, his illustrations for, like, The Witches are perfect. But yeah.
Yeah.
He's not quite the right illustrator for this.
So, yeah, we're getting towards the end of the book.
Yeah, it's just, like where what is this plot? What is the plot?
And then they age the various grandparents back to the age that they started with. So, cool. and then Mr. Wonka gets a letter from the president inviting them all to a special celebration for saving some of the
yeah, of good the point. Yeah, some of the they save the astronauts, so
And that is enough to finally get the remaining grandparents out of bed. And
I hate the fact that a visit to the White House is treated as more extraordinary, more exciting, more wondrous than, like, going into space and meeting aliens and venturing into an astral plane. It's like, oh no, we've transcended space and time, but the really big deal here is meeting the president and getting a medal.
Yeah. What? Yeah.
And that's it. That's it. Like,
that's it.
That's it. That, it's that, really that, abrupt.
That's the book.
And okay, so it ends. A group of extremely important-looking gentlemen came towards them and bowed. "Well, Charlie," said Grandpa Joe, "it's certainly been a busy day." "It's not over yet," Charlie said, laughing. "It hasn't even begun." Like, what? what do you mean it hasn't begun? That's the end of the book. Like,
yeah. Well, why did you just tell us all of this? Why?
And there's not a sequel to this book.
No.
So it definitely has begun and finished. You know, we don't get Charlie and the American president.
No. Or even, like, another book where we experience the whimsy and wonders of the chocolate factory. Imagine that.
No, we've had monstrous egg aliens and some kind of weird astral realm based on mathematics. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And some really, really pointless songs that aren't very good.
Thanks, Roald. That was...
This is a hot mess of a book.
It really is.
I think I knew something was up with the book as a kid, but I don't think I made a kind of quality judgment. Now as an adult, I was like, what is this? Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, as a kid, I was just like, this makes me feel bad. Now I'm like, this... No, just on every level. I feel like it would be out of print if that wouldn't, like, create more demand for it. I don't know. I think it just has to, like... It's just... People need to collectively ignore it, I guess.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. It's so odd, because he can write really good stories, right? He is excellent at plotting. Matilda has excellent, and Matilda's late, right? So it's not as though he started good and tailed off. Matilda is one of his last books, and Matilda is perfectly plotted.
Yeah.
I know some of the early ones, like James and the Giant Peach is very much one thing after another. But it makes sense.
Yeah.
The only thing I'm glad of is that now that Netflix own the right to All Roald Dahl, someone presumably is going to have to make a film of it. Someone probably right now is crying as they try to make this into a screenplay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who would direct it, do you reckon?
Ari Aster. I don't know.
That would be great, actually. Yeah, yeah, all right. I'd be up for that. Yeah. Maybe Ari Aster can collaborate with Jan Trankmar for his final film.
Yeah. Just let them loose on it.
Yeah, yeah. it's a hard to illustrate book, and I suspect a remarkably unfilmable book. That makes me really want to film with it, because
Yeah, I mean, watch this space.
We're gonna be straight on the scene if there is a film of this.
Yeah, the Netflix adaptation of. I mean, we said they wouldn't do the Swan, and apparently they did the Swan.
That's a fair point.
Which I haven't seen yet. Did you?
No, I haven't actually.
Okay.
Didn't we? I thought we did. Did we talk about the Netflix versions of?
No.
Oh, I did see it. Okay. Yeah, it's all right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Or maybe you just said that. Maybe you're just like, oh, it's all right.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, the Wes Anderson ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's just a really odd choice for Roald Dahl, because he's so deliberately textureless. in it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I quite like some Wes Anderson. You know, I love Royal Tenenbaums. And Grand Budapest Hotel was great. Mm. So, you know, I do like him, but obviously it's all very particular and just so and clockwork-like, and that's why it's pleasing, a lot of it.
Yeah.
And the emotions just going to show through the cracks. But, yeah. I don't know. He's a very odd choice for Roald Dahl, because Roald Dahl tends to be too much. It tends to be grotesque and over-textured and a bit unruly and odd. So...
Yeah.
Yeah. A very strange person to be... to be doing the adaptations. I mean, I don't know if there's any more Roald Dahl for us to talk about. I mean, the thing is, there is horror in, you know, like the BFG scared me quite a lot as a kid, and you know, we could always talk about the animation, obviously.
But you know, it was quite well trodden territory.
True, it's more well trodden. I don't think...
I feel like we'll come back to Roald
Dahl. Yeah, I don't think even we could make a case for The Giraffe, the Pelly and Me being a horror.
Oh. Well, that's nice. Let's cut this off by thinking about The Giraffe and the Pelly and Me.
Yeah, which is a lovely, cosy book. That, yeah. That, you know, children will actually enjoy rather than just being confused by.
Yeah. Right. I think...
Yeah, let's finish. It's a bad book.
But I had a good time talking about it.
Oh yeah, best avoided, but fun to talk about.
Yeah. All right. So our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. The details are in the show notes. We are officially off Twitter.
Oh, are we officially? You can follow. Well done.
Yeah. And I just can't be bothered with Blue Sky, I'm sorry. So we're now, you can now find us at Still Scared Podcast on Instagram or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com.
To be honest, we should probably change our Gmail, but it's so hard getting away from Google. Guys, I feel like I've signed up to so many things over the years for my Gmail.
Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Not really. I normally do, but I just like, I don't know. Just read The Giraffe, the Pelly, and Me, creepy kids. Do yourself a favour.
Yeah.
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 Bye.
Bye. See you next time.